Welcome, good evening. I've been thinking recently about spiritual practice such as Zen as being or finding an appropriate balance of, on the one hand, we could say stability, and on the other hand, change. Or we could say it, a balance of security and risk, or safety and danger, or abiding in comfort and stepping into fear. Maybe we could even say conservative and radical, but not in a political sense. You have some sense of these two sides of practice that I think are two just in everyone's life in general, but I think we can look at a practice in terms of these two aspects and how to balance them. And this balance will be different for each person. And I think it will be different for each individual at different phases of their life, and maybe be different throughout any given day, actually. It seems that beginning a practice, we need to emphasize this first side more, of stability, security, safety, abiding in comfort. And as we then develop more stability over time, then we need, I think in practice, more of this change, risk, danger, stepping into fear. We might even look at our practice as traditionally Buddhist practice. It's like first there's growing up at home in the security of our family, being taken care of to greater or lesser extent. Sometimes home is not so secure. But if it is, then there's that time of leaving home. We call, even in our Zen center here, we call a priest ordination leaving home. And so in a way that's kind of stepping into a more unknown. And so Edie just did this ceremony of leaving home, and there's the cutting off of one's hair, which in itself, I think just that in itself is kind of like a risk and danger. it's symbolic of like letting go of what's comfortable and familiar. So it's a nice tradition since the time of Buddha, we keep that. But that's like part of who I am. For me, that was actually like a radical physical action for me. I had quite long hair, and to cut it off like that was frightening, actually. It felt like part of my identity was wrapped into it and dropped away. So, and some other traditions, they do the opposite. Like Mount Madonna Center, our fellow yogis down the road, they have the practice of growing their hair, you know, without cutting it, as a kind of renunciation, letting, and not really like doing anything about it, so it just turns into dreadlocks. That's another Indian style of letting something go. Depending on maybe where we're at in the first place. For me, as a long-haired person, I think this is the perfect practice of change for me. So then there's, we could say that leaving home is a kind of shifting the balance from stability into kind of risk or the unknown. And then traditionally there might be a phase of like living in the monastery, and now stability develops again. We've left home, but there's another kind of stability develops. And then after some time in the monastery, even from ancient times, there's a leaving the monastery, leaving the familiar stability and stepping into the unknown again. A new risk, which also I would say for me, having kind of lived that kind of life, it was a step into an unknown risk to leave Tassajara and come here, actually. So back and forth as our practice goes along. We have stories too, like Dogen, our ancient ancestor, kind of followed that pattern. After some years in the monastery, he felt like he needed to go to China to find even more authentic Dharma practice. And at that time, in the 13th century, it doesn't look so far nowadays, but to cross the Japan Sea from Japan to China was really risking one's life. That's how Dogen himself talks about it. And apparently there were some big storms where it was on the edge, maybe, of whether the ship would make it. Dogen would sit zazen in the big storms. So we have many stories of our ancestors kind of actually risking their bodily lives for the sake of practice and deepening their understanding and compassion. Maybe we could say the reason that over time we can step out of the security more into the risk is because the illusion of the separate fixed self becomes more and more transparent. And in a way, that's really the cause of, I think it's fair to say, all our fear comes from the illusion of the independent self. So even if it's not completely dropped away, maybe our fear of many things and ultimately death itself becomes a little bit less, so we can step more into the unknown. Like, for example, Trungpa Rinpoche once said, "The bad news is that we've jumped out of an airplane and realized that we have no parachute. But the good news is that there's no ground." So maybe at first we feel as if I would never jump out of an airplane with no parachute. But maybe at some point, if we trust a little bit more that there is no ground to land on, may be possible. So, Zen centers like this one, I think, are designed, and like the ancient monasteries too, designed to kind of emphasize more the security, stability, safety, abiding, and comfort part of the mix. Maybe almost any group institution is actually emphasizing that side, and the risk, change, stepping into danger is more of an individual practice. It's not like a whole group's gonna step into risk. Maybe just it wouldn't happen appropriately and possibly. So more group-oriented practice is more, we could also say, conservative, and individual practice has the possibility to be more radical, we might say. So that's part of our job here, is to maintain the stability, especially for newer practitioners, to really feel that Zazen's like the same time every day. We're not just going to mix it up. And in fact, we, you know, when we say the period is 40 minutes, we, as far as I know, since I've been here, we've never kind of like changed the bell from what it says on the schedule. I've heard that in early days at San Francisco Zen Center, sometimes they would do that. They had a schedule, but I think Suzuki Roshi sometimes even would say, just don't ring the bell, let's just, you know, see what happens. And I think it was about this very issue of stability, security versus like fear of the unknown and risk. What if it never rings? Or what if it really is on time, but my sense of time is so warped that it seems like 5 hours. Maybe it really is. But I think it's nice that we don't do that. Sometimes people here even check just before it rings, just, and they see, oh, maybe it's 30 seconds off, but it's close. So in a way, as a group, we kind of maintain that sight, and as individuals, then it's almost like it's kind of up to us individually to find our own challenge, to take our own risk, just thinking of our Zen practice as a whole. Sometimes I think we offer each other challenges in the group. Naturally this happens, some too, but not so much, and I think it's maybe appropriate that it's not so much. Maybe in a quite close teacher-student relationship, then it becomes almost more individual. Then it's like, well, for you, at this time, why don't you try this? And then, because they know each other, where they're at in their practice, but not as a whole group process. I think more individual when I think about this. One of my Tibetan teachers recently brought up the kind of practice opportunities he offered around this kind of thing. I think in a way offered to people who have some stability in their practice and want to maybe tested is not exactly the right word, because then the self can get in there and design its own tests, but maybe just to like open to possible fear. He said it's nice sometimes when you're feeling settled in your practice to, if there's a roller coaster near your town, they aren't really in every town, right? But if you can ride a roller coaster, it could be a good practice to just, and really pay attention actually on the roller coaster when your stomach's dropping out and what's going on in your body and mind? What's going on to your sense of self? Are you gripping the bar like with white knuckles for dear life? And so I think that's interesting. I haven't been on the roller coaster here in a while, but I enjoy that aspect of it when I do go on that Big Dipper. Is that what it is? I think the fact that it's one of those, I think it's the oldest roller coaster in the country. Has anyone heard that? I'm pretty sure. And I'm sure it's been restored over the years, but you look at it and it looks like this kind of creaky old wooden thing with this roller coaster flying around it. So maybe the actual rational mind gets in there and goes, I actually don't know about this safety of this thing. It looks kind of precarious. It's so old. What if the wood's rotten? And of course, some people who want to experience or maybe experiment with their sense of self, young people will stand up in the roller coaster, which you're not supposed to do, right? And I think people have died occasionally on the roller coaster. So there's some risk involved, but it could be maybe not as much risk as driving over Highway 17. Actually, but it feels like it. Or maybe even more extreme, skydiving. So I've never done. Some people might say, actually, that's like inappropriate. That's really like enough people die skydiving that it's like it's risking your life too much for not enough benefit, cheap thrill or something. But I don't know. I've never really talked to skydivers about that, but I could imagine that some, maybe it's like just the adrenaline rush, right, of the excitement. But I think I have seen maybe a documentary on skydiving where they talk about it as really feeling alive because of the risk, actually. I think partly because of the risk that it would be very easy to die, and partly because you're jumped out of an airplane for a little while without a parachute and free falling through the sky. So maybe in a way that the danger and risk does make us feel more alive, and some people will go to extreme extent to find that edge of their lives. You know, rock climbing would be another one. For us, maybe within our group tradition, I think Sesshin is, in some ways, has some of these elements, right? It pushes the body sometimes to its very edge of what's possible. I've definitely felt in Sesshin like this is not possible to not move any longer. And then it's like the limit, and then somehow there can be a surrender, and we go beyond our limit. And which our limit is somewhat connected to our sense of self. So we go beyond that, and there's a new, fresh feeling of life there. This kind of dangerous practices like Sesshin also have the danger of like the, you know, wanting to get the excitement or something that comes with it. I think that wouldn't be the right motivation. But more being outside our habitual structure in a way that we like come into the present very directly and into like the center of our life and our kind of expanded life. We all have these experiences, and we love them and hate them, right? Usually that kind of goes together. Usually these kind of something like, I think probably people who've skydived thousands of times, every time they're going up into the plane, they're going to have the jitters. It's never going to be like, oh, great, I finally got totally comfortable skydiving. I imagine that probably for all of them, it's going to be like when you're stepping out the door, how did I get here again? But we're drawn back. I think we have that experience with Sesshin, too. At the end of Sesshin, I finished it, I don't think I'll ever do it again. And then we find a couple months later or a year later, we're stepping back in, and on the second day we think, uh-oh, how did I get myself into this again? And then sometimes the miracle happens of it opens up into our life. Yes.
Can I share a story along those lines? I was helping a friend lead probation kids on week-long rock climbing trips to Yosemite back in the 70s. And we were teaching them how to rappel off these cliffs. And this one kid just was scared to death. But he realized everyone else had done it. He was last. And so he forced himself over the edge, and he was going down like this. And then his frown changed to a smile. And then he got down and he said, "Hell, this is better than dope!"
Sometimes it's like we just have to jump in.
Yeah.
And there's no other way but jumping in, and then the joy comes. So it's like a trust. I think this side of the practice is about trust. And the first part of the stability part is about building the trust, actually. I think the more stable and secure we have, we might not have so much trust in our the unknown or our practice or life, the community together helps build it over and over, and then we're maybe ready to jump out. So you know, for me in my life, I think, well, I tend to actually, to be honest, I think I fall more into the first side. I really like regularity, stability. I like to follow the same schedule all the time. It's comforting for me. I think that's maybe why I've been practicing Zen for so long. But I know that I need this other side too. And Zen practice offers some of it, but I think also for me, one thing that I've found has been wonderful in this way is traveling. Especially traveling to, you know, very different cultures with different languages. Like in Asia, mostly traveling, especially early on. I think a lot of people travel for some of this reason. It's like stepping into the unknown, going on a trip to a completely unfamiliar place, and sometimes we can't plan it that much. So sometimes there actually is a danger to the body. I'm thinking India in particular. You know, I remember the first time you read about all these diseases and like, you know, you can get all these super expensive immunizations or you can take some risks and you get some of them. And you kind of, you know, now I kind of know that the body will get sick. Maybe once going over there it didn't get sick, but it's kind of like, it's a risk and some people get incurably sick, you know, hepatitis or something. So and that's in a way part of the, maybe it sounds strange, but part of the, I think, opening in a place like that is, it is a risk. And the first time I went to India, I went alone, which now seems crazy. But I was so young, and I met a friend over there, but the first couple weeks were alone, and I remember first getting there, I'd never been out of this country at all. It was so outside my experience. I finally found the room, guest house room that I had, you know, been looking for, somehow got in there. And I remember waking up the next morning and hearing just like the chaos outside around and just be like, what if I just don't leave this room? I made it this far. Now I can say I've been to India. Just maybe I could like somehow try to find a ride back to the airport, and for days it would go on like that in the mornings, just like really having to work up the kind of courage to literally like leave the hotel room, and then of course adventures ensue. Another time in China, did a group Zen pilgrimage to lots of Zen temples with a official guided tour, with Chinese speakers and tour guides and very nice hotels on a bus, all arranged. But then me and a few friends decided, well, let's now that we're all the way over here and we did a quick zip through these Zen temples, let's stay a little bit longer and just actually try to practice at some of these places that we got to visit. And I just remember the moment, there were three of us where they dropped us off and they were all about to fly back and on the big tour bus, and they were looking out the back window at the three of us and they were all waving and we were waving back, and this feeling in my heart like, oh no, what have we done? There's not that much English spoken in once you get out of the bigger cities in China, and none of us could speak Chinese and could write a few characters, and that fear of like we're in the middle of this huge country and with, you know, a few little maps and big plans, but that wonderful feeling, it's like fear but also like this openness you know, it's like everything's in a way more vibrant and alive because of that unknown, I think. And again, many adventures, and I remember often it didn't work out so well. There's one night in trying to find this train to the next city, and the train station was getting ready to close, but we needed to buy this ticket, just trying to communicate, and the person, it was late at night, you could tell they were tired, and they just were not going to be patient with these English speakers, and there was nobody else around to ask. We tried, but nobody spoke English, and they just shut the window on us, the ticket window, and like, but we can't get on the train, and just that, like, feeling of, again, what are we going to do? Again, I guess we'll just live in this train station the rest of our lives. But of course that didn't happen, right? We're on the edge of, I mean, suffering. There's suffering and distress there, but that's part of this side of risk. Maybe the security side is we're trying to minimize the suffering. And if this is all about practice, it's all about relief from suffering, but maybe the risk danger side is kind of being willing to go into some suffering in order to find some freedom there. Whereas this other side is, I don't really want to risk suffering. It's a balance, again. So we have a Zen story. I mean, many Zen stories about this, but one comes to mind in particular. Some of you might have heard this story. Case 79 in the Book of Serenity. Changsha advancing a step. And the introduction to this case. Actually, an introduction to all Zen koans, Zen stories. This is a Tenshin Roshi was on this kick for a while, talking about Zen stories all being about some kind of crisis. And apparently the Chinese character for crisis has the etymology being made up of these two different radicals. One means danger and one means opportunity. Do you remember this story? So a crisis is both a danger and an opportunity. And he said Zen stories are all about this. They have their Zen stories offer a dangerous situation that's also an opportunity. And I think that's what the story is about. The introduction to the story says, amongst other things, stuffing pastries in a crystal jar, who would dare to roll it? You gotta love these strange Zen images. But I take that as this crystal jar, very, very fragile, thin glass, stuffing it full of yummy pastries, and then maybe you want to like roll it over to your friend. But it's a very fragile jar stuffed full of pastries. So who would dare to roll this jar of pastries? Because it'll crack and the glass will get all mixed in with the pastries, right? That's how I would take that image. This, here's from the next line in the introduction, maybe more straightforward. Without going into the frightening waves, it's hard to find a satisfying fish. I think danger and opportunity. So here's the story. Changsha had a monk, one of his students, ask his Dharma brother, Master Hui, how was it before you saw Nanchuan, our teacher? So Changsha and this hermit Hui were Dharma brothers. And one of them actually lived in the institutional monastery, and one was a wild hermit in the mountains. And the one in the monastery is sending one of his students out to the mountains to find him and sort of like check him out by asking this question. They were both students of Nan Chuan, the great Nan Chuan. So he says, can you go ask my Dharma brother Hui, how was it before you saw Nan Chuan? And Hui, the hermit, just remained silent. And the monk again asked, how was it after seeing Nan Chuan? And Hui said, nothing special. Or, there couldn't be anything else. Just this. Kind of like that. Nothing special. Kind of a little Zen response, right? So then the monk came back to Changsha, and Changsha felt like, I mean, that sounds good, but he recited this verse. Changsha said, the person sitting atop the 100-foot pole, though he's gained entry, or he has some understanding, still this is not yet the real thing. There's not yet the genuine. Atop the 100-foot pole, he should step forward, and the whole universe in all directions will be the whole body. Stepping forward off the 100-foot pole, could say, you know, nothing special comes from some Zen practice that this hermit had been doing. Not bad, but maybe in other stories that would have been enough, but Changsha felt like there's still something, I feel like it's not dynamic enough, maybe. He's got to step forward off the top of his pole. And Changsha recited that verse, and then the messenger monk, who had told him about his hermit friend's answer, the monk said, well, atop the 100-foot pole, how can you step forward, Changsha? And Changsha said, the mountains of Lan, the rivers of Li province, which we can imagine that it's this, maybe the county where they live, and the mountains and rivers that are the whole expanse of the land they live in. How can you step forward off the top of this pole? Santa Cruz County and Watsonville and Monterey too, I could say. And the monk said, I don't understand. And Changsha said, the whole land is within the emperor's domain or control. Or I could say, the whole county is, you know, under the mayor's care, something like that. So the top of the 100-foot pole is a kind of it takes some work to get there, but it's still a kind of a narrow place. It has a nice view. It's kind of dangerous to be up there, but also a little bit safe if we don't step forward. We could fall, but actually to step forward off of the 100-foot pole sounds terrifying, especially without a parachute. So, how can you step forward? The entire county or country, land, the entire planet, the whole universe, we might even say. I don't understand. Well, this whole land is under the, you know, here it says imperial sway, but maybe we could say under the gentle care of the one true ruler, which is our true being, our true self, yeah, which can't be lost and it has no limits. So that's the story. In the commentary, Changsha's famous statement, in the same spirit, he seemed to be into this view of vastness And the interrelationship between the individual person and the whole and the experience of that, this is, I think, a beautiful statement of Changsha's that gets quoted by Dogen in various essays. Changsha says, the whole universe in all directions is the eyeball of a practitioner. The whole universe in all directions is the whole body of a practitioner. The whole universe in all directions is the light of the true self. The whole universe in all directions is within one's own light. In all the universes, in all directions, there is no one that is not oneself. So, in that spirit, that's how one can step off the top of the 100-foot pole. And they'll be like, I don't know about that, or I don't trust that, but maybe when stepping off, it could be that that's what's realized. And Dogen picks up this story about stepping off the pole and his record of things heard, the Shobogenza Zuimonki. Dogen says, an ancient teacher said, at the top of 100-foot pole, advance one step further. This means we should have the attitude of someone who, at the top of 100-foot pole, lets go with both hands and feet. In other words, we must drop off body and mind. It's another way of saying, step off the top of the 100-foot pole. Then Dogen says, there's various stages involved here. And he goes on for a few pages, but to summarize them, basically, he says, he's saying the things that we're holding on to at the top of the pole that we have to let go of. He says, first, we have a kind of, a particular fond attachment to our home and our world and our, familiar place. So we let go of that. We could say that's like the leaving home part. But then we could still have attachment to our small self, our individual separate self. And along with that, attachment to fame and profit. And Dogen and a lot of the Zen ancestors bring up these two a lot. In the early foundational teachings, there's more like emphasis on attachment to sense pleasures. But as the foundational vehicle shifted into the great vehicle of Mahayana, the senses became a little bit more like, okay, they're a little bit, they can cause trouble. We can get attached to, and we do get attached to pleasure over pain. But even more sticky in the Mahayana is this fame and profit, or we might say reputation and material security. Those are big, aren't they? And I think both individually and institutionally, we can identify with an institution and kind of have a kind of attachment to the reputation of the institution. I'm practicing in San Francisco Zen Center, the flagship of Zen in the United States. Don't mess with me or it. In fact, I am it, really. I've been there for a while. So almost like the individual reputation gets connected with an institutional reputation, quite unconsciously, I think. And then the material security part, my individual financial and material security also expands to, we got to keep the institution materially secure. which means that we better keep the reputation secure too. So these are not bad things. They're, you know, conventionally speaking, they help make things work smoothly especially in the realm that the institutions are trying to maintain, which is the stability and the security. But if we get too caught in that side, then we miss the fully alive, unknown dimension of, well, maybe I won't last anyway. Maybe my reputation won't last, my material security won't last, maybe the institution won't last either. And is that okay? Actually, I don't think any institution has lasted in the history of the planet so far. But some have gone on for a long time. So this balance, I've been thinking about this balance recently, and I encourage us all to find ways to notice what we need in the balance. Do we need more security? Sometimes we do. Stability, or are we kind of coasting along in a kind of comfortable haze, and we need to stir it up. And then we stir it up too much and we get totally destabilized and like, okay, back to the schedule. I think it's natural to go back and forth like this, but sometimes we can get really stuck in one side or the other. So, I ask myself, how can I find ways? Travel's good, but various ways, day to day, where we can kind of like, even integrating these more while maintaining stability, keep that edge, that alive edge of practice and the unknown. So I invite your questions or comments or suggestions or what you find helpful in finding this balance. Yes, Patrick.
I was just thinking that the willingness to kind of keep facing your edge really kind of keeps one opened up.
Yeah. Willingness is a huge part. Mm-hmm.
And that kind of beginner's mind.
Yes.
I don't know what to expect here, so I want my awareness to be broad. I might be seeing things that I haven't seen before, so I want to try to approach those new things skillfully.
Yeah. Beginner's mind, don't know mind, the mind of just, I really don't know. And it's so hard to keep that mind when it's like, especially if we start going into a fearful situation, then like, I need something to stand on. So at least I can know this or that. In a way, maybe complete beginner's mind or complete don't know mind, in a way, is stepping off the pole, actually. You could say it's the attitude to be ready to step off the pole, but in a way, if it's complete, that is it. Yeah, thank you. Yes, Ken?
I feel like, in one sense, like I've fallen off a lot of flagpoles, but, you know, like, unintentionally. Got hurt.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is, of course, that hard part.
Yeah.
And, like you said about Trump, I was saying that, it's groundless. But in other aspects, sometimes it sounds like a funhouse where it's going to be padded when you jump off.
Mm.
And it's going to be, everything's going to be okay.
Mm.
And, of course, there's a hesitation there. And,
you mean because we think it's maybe not really a funhouse?
It's not, yeah, maybe it's not really a funhouse.
Yeah.
Because again, it's
yeah.
Like, we've all come off of this, and then so the idea of constantly saying, okay, I'm going to just let go again. You know, it just seems kind of counterintuitive, being that that's why we came here, because we fell down a lot of times.
Mm.
Well,
in a way, I think it's both sides. We came here because we fell off and got hurt a lot, and we came here because we know we have to let go.
Yeah.
Right? So I think it's both sides. And in a way, those are the two sides. We came here for some security and stability because we fell off and got hurt, and we came here because we know we have to go beyond all our ideas about everything, actually, at the same time. And there's one and the other. Yeah, so I think it's true that falling off accidentally usually doesn't work. Or if someone pushes us off, also I think it doesn't work. Again, in a very intimate and trusting teacher-student relationship, like a lot of these Zen stories, it does seem a little bit like somebody's pushed off the edge. But only when there's a... I think those kind of pushes in these stories are when the student actually is ready. Just ready and just like teetering, and the teacher just dink. Just a little helpful, maybe more like a nudge. Yes, Dana. Oh, did you have more?
Well, the falling off is... It does cause change. It's not a selfless change. It's not where you can actually let go of yourself. So I'm just trying to clarify.
You mean if?
Like when I was making that analogy about falling off, it's not a selfless fall. It's more it caused change. You know, there's turning points. In your
you mean the accidental?
Yeah.
That's right.
But the difference being that it's not selfless.
That's right. Yeah, the accidental falling and getting hurt is usually not selfless. And that's why I get hurt, actually. And then, but consciously, maybe even it's the same situation I was in before that I accidentally fell off and got hurt, but now I'm consciously stepping, and then maybe we still get hurt, or not, because now I'm actually ready. And the reason now, when I fell, it had nothing to do with selflessness, but when I'm consciously stepping, it's for the reason. I think in this whole thing as a Zen practice is ideally the stepping off is our bodhisattva vow. I vow to let go of my narrow self-centeredness in any way I can. And I'd rather not do it this way, but but maybe there's no other way. Because just standing here on top of the pole is the self-centeredness. Mm. Yes, Lena.
I'm extending out my share of planned and not planned steering myself into the ditch. So I think I very much agree with how you're talking about, you know, kind of the level of risk and balance that we take in our individual lives. I would just want to say that there's a lot of variation. Kind of things that we don't choose.
Yeah. Like
cancer.
Yeah.
Climbers,
that's right.
Accidents that result in, you know, more or less permanent changes in our life.
Mm-hmm.
Kinds of states. But I want to ask you about the institutional analogy, because I think you probably know. I don't agree with you there. If you think about the history of San Francisco Zen, they make the front page of the New York Times either for sexual indiscretions or for being drunk most of the time or being absent most of the time. How do you think about those? Because in those cases, the teacher is the institution. And, I mean, no one would say Richard Baker did us a great favor, right? Except that now we have this incredible collection of artifacts. We spent a lot of money on that.
Yeah. And even then, maybe however many decades later, maybe we can see it out of the intensity of that pain. Maybe some people might, maybe the ones who were directly involved with him in that pain, maybe would never see it as a positive thing, but maybe those who came later could see, actually, maybe the whole fiasco was perfect for Zen Center.
Sure.
It matured it.
And,
Yeah.
So, what what you say to them about the growing for kind of the good balance that the institution had, because put it, the institution, you know, there were some damages done. We have such high regard for Trungpa. And I know people that practice with Trungpa and Suzuki Roshi, where the bells didn't ring for 3 or 4 hours. Just for fun.
And you could say that's part of the institution. In some ways, I guess the way I was thinking about it when talking was more like by the institution, so it's not a black and white line, right? I saw more like the institution is where you do have the set schedule, actually, and you have the stability, and then within the institution, then there's these individuals, and it could be the abbot, like Suzuki Roshi says, probably was mostly him who would say, actually don't ring the bell, and then that's kind of within the institution, it's the individual challenging either themselves or the others intentionally or unintentionally, you know, maybe like in Richard Baker's case, it wasn't meant to be like, let's see if the community can handle this, right? It was more of not at all.
I don't even know that it has an intention or a plan.
Yeah.
It's more an expression.
Yeah. But in some ways, I could still see it like that's the individual within the institution destabilizing the institution for bodhisattva reasons or for self-centered reasons.
Yeah.
Or,
I just want to say to people that I know they go back to that period.
Mm-hmm.
I just know a couple of people that don't practice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so... And even then we might say, yeah, I heard those stories about when this whole fiasco with Baker Roshi happened and one of the senior priests actually burned his robes because he was so disappointed with his teacher and that who ordained him, Baker Roshi. And later he reconnected with him and became his Dharma heir. But at the time when burned his robes, when I heard that story, I thought, I mean, I wasn't there in the intensity of the pain, but I thought, seems like something's wrong. And even, you know, just to take that example, I thought, something seems wrong because it seemed like there was too much trust in this individual person that was actually, you know, what's that? The individual person doing their own thing. And not enough trust in the Dharma. I kind of had the thought, well, I would want to put my trust in the practice and the Dharma that we know we can trust. And then when the crazy things happen, which they do and will, that, well, it's all falling apart, but my robes are about the Dharma and the practice. We could say, well, I got them from that teacher, so it's maybe mixed, but I wondered about that when I heard it. And maybe that's part of the danger of institutions and people connected with them, is you project the entire Zen practice and all its legitimacy onto one person like that, which I think can happen. Then when the person fails, it's like, that means the practice fails, rather than, no, one person fell off the practice. Does that make sense? That's, when I heard that story, I thought, that seems like something was wrong with the practice, that it that people felt like the practice, like when you say people stopped practicing completely, it seems like it was too much about that person rather than, well, that's just a fallible human, but the practice I will trust forever.
This is a pretty mature practitioner to say, regardless of the teacher.
I think you're right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When they disappoint us, it's you know, it requires this kind of looking inward and maybe separating the practice from the teacher. But still, to me, that's different than the institution. I understand that institutions should maybe take some risks, think about new paths and all of that, but I wonder about that, because one could look, for example, at the history of, you know, Minnesota Zen Center, San Francisco Zen Center, any number of Zen centers that have regrettably graced the pages of the New York Times, not Mm-hmm. It's difficult, I think, to tease out the difference between the teachers and the institution. Mm. I mean, from a very kind of more mature practitioner level, I think we could say you stay with the practice regardless of what's happening.
Yeah.
It's like you stay whether Donald Trump gets elected or not.
Yes. Yeah, so in a way, maybe that is it's a more advanced practice to actually separate those, and we have to be careful not to confuse them. But in a way, we could say that that could have been, we could look at, at least I could see, that could be one benefit of the Richard Baker scandal, is that through a lot of pain and suffering, people actually learned then to trust the practice more and actually rearranged the structure of the Zen Center and so on because of it. And that was a healthy thing, that if it hadn't happened, and Sasaki Roshi, I think, too, was even more about this person. And if it hadn't happened that way, it would have kept going on, maybe in this kind of like, kind of off-track way. So it helped... It helped break the projection on the person, maybe. And maybe, this maybe is a big stretch, but maybe, because I've heard this kind of thing in similar situations, maybe Baker Roshi unconsciously, I don't think consciously, but maybe unconsciously felt that's what has to happen. He felt something's getting like, this isn't how I was practicing with Suzuki Roshi. I'm getting so separate from the students. There was already a lot of dis-ease, right? And maybe he felt like, we gotta like, crack this open in a big way. I say unconscious, right?
I understand the Vietnam War was a great thing because it, you know, created a movement that created, in turn, you know, something about American
yeah.
policy.
Yeah.
Yeah,
nothing's black and white, right? Everything has good and bad sides, like the story of the guy who got the horse, and then the horse died, and it broke. So, we wish that in the changes and transformations that happen, we wish, and that's a bodhisattva vow. We wish that as little harm as possible happens to as few beings as possible. And in the transformation, there may be some pain. And I think putting it more on a personal level, maybe we all have that experience, I know I do, that often it's the painful times in my life that are the places of growing. Almost 100%. It's those places of like difficulty and where, like standing at the top of a 100-foot pole and having to jump. But we want to minimize it, I think, as much as we can. Gene.
I'll hold my question because I think we're close to ending time.
Oh, yes, we are. Did you have a quick?
A quick one. I wanted to say, all my life has been going to a strange place, leaving home for college, leaving college for work, having a family, and me being a family, and so on. And then these scary changes succeeding became undergone.
Yes, yeah.
You didn't mention that, but it occurred to me that every time we jumped into the strange place, it can become a home.
I think
and
so.
Also, when the rug gets tore out from under.
Yeah.
And when I had to quit drinking, for instance, and then the cancer diagnosis, it's just like, okay, but every time I've jumped into something new before, it's become my new home. So
yeah.
I'll hang on to that.
Well, it's kind of like mentioning the, you leave home to go to the monastery, but then the monastery becomes a home, mm-hmm. and you have to leave that. And then there's a new one, yeah, over and over. Yeah. Well, may all beings find this balance of deep security, nurturing stability, and that will enable all of us to then leap into the unknown. And may our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.